underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Annie Prue is the author of 10 books, including the novel The Shipping News, which won a Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Her short story, Brokeback Mountain, was made into an Academy Award-winning film. Her new novel, Barkskins, imagines the forging of a new world through humanity's insatiable appetite for timber and through two families intertwined in the early onslaught of modern global deforestation. It is a great pleasure and an honor to welcome Annie Prue to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a delight.
Well, my pleasure entirely.
When you take on a subject like deforestation, and this is a 700-plus page book, one of the things that struck me at the conclusion was you must have had to rein yourself in at some point that it could have been larger because the subject is so large. It could have not just been deforestation. It could have been climate change.
Yes.
And on and on.
Exactly, yes. For deforestation itself was massive, but the whole book is to indicate that it's part of a much larger thing, that is climate change. That in itself, I almost would like to suggest that it is part of the new emphasis on, or argument actually, on the Anthropocene. We have been living in the Holocene epoch for the last 12,000 years or so, but it's been suggested that now we are in the Anthropocene. I think the Dutch atmospheric scientist Crutzen suggested this about 15 years ago. And there's a big argument about it. But if I had to place Barkskins anywhere, it would be as a kind of Anthropocene literature. And art museums and artists have jumped on this new term and are painting wonderful and disturbing things. People, houses balanced on the point of land, and underneath all has been eroded away. I don't know how large that field is for literature, but this probably belongs there.
When you look at that period, and certainly the period that you read about, it's over 300 years, again, only a snapshot, really, a slice of it, but it does tell us a lot, doesn't it?
I hope so. There's such a lot to know. So much had to be left out. So it's skeletal, this book, even though it's got lots of pages. It just can hint at some of what we should know or might know or ought to know.
Was there a point through the editing process where you did have to rein it in, where the manuscript was much larger?
Absolutely. About 150 pages had to be cut from the original manuscript. And this didn't happen in one fell swoop. It was actually a process of back and forth between me and the editor until it was whittled down to a more compact size.
And through that process, do you feel that you, as the writer, lost something that you would have loved to have been in there?
What do you think? Most definitely, yes. Yes, I regretted losing many, many bits. The characters who carry the story were not really cut at all. Some of them were tossed, but most of them stayed in place, doing their best to get the story from point A to point X.
When it comes to that point A to point X, you know what X is.
Yes.
When you start, you know what X is.
I think I do anyway, yes.
I've heard you say you often write X maybe first.
In the past, I have done that. I did not write the ending of this first, or rather I did. I wrote a different ending and had to change it somewhat because I couldn't fulfill what I wanted to do for the final section. My plan was to spend some time in Indonesia because I wanted to write about log poaching in Indonesia, and I simply couldn't get there, and I couldn't get it done, and I was out of time. So it saved several hundred pages.
Talk about the travel required for this. You did quite a bit of traveling and living in other places over the 10 years in the writing of this novel.
I did. It took a long time, and it's been going on for years, looking at places, thinking about this, not specifically this book, but just thinking about the whole business of deforestation and trees and the world we live in and how much we've changed it and climate change and what's going on. So the travel, I went several times for other reasons, but did research on the kauri trees in New Zealand and visited Australia several times and have been around the United States and Canada, of course. Many years ago, we won't say how many, I did go to Brazil and was in the Amazon for a bit. Memories of that were helpful in writing the Amazonian part of the book.
I would think those memories would be quite strong.
Indeed, yes.
Meaning seeing those sights and seeing those trees of how that affects you and stays with you.
Yeah, I have a memory for landscape. It's always been a keen interest of mine, so it isn't something you erase or forget.
I'm hoping you can read us just a little bit of the beginning of the novel, a paragraph in which you talk about the landscape and set up the, as I mentioned, the very beginning of the novel, Barkskins.
This is in the year 1693, and the place is New France. The characters are two indentured servants who are being hurried along by their new master to the place where they're going to live. In a few hours, the sodden leaf mold gave way to pine duff. The air was extremely aromatic. Fallen needles muted their passage. The interlaced branches absorbed their panting breaths. Here grew hugeous trees of a size not seen in the old country for hundreds of years. Evergreens taller than cathedrals, cloud-piercing spruce and hemlock. The monstrous deciduous trees stood distant from each other, but overhead their leaf-choked branches merged into a false sky, dark and savage. Achille, his older brother, would have gaped at New France's trees. Late in the day, they passed by a slope filled with shining white trunks. These, said Monsieur Trépanier, were bouleau blanc, and the sauvages made houses and boats from the bark. René did not believe this.
Annie Proulx reading from her new novel, Barkskins. That terrain seems as though it's always important to you and how it affects the characters. So the story comes from that landscape.
Yes, throughout the landscape is the master of the story and its changes. Mutilation, its intense efforts to recover, and the people who go into it and do it harm and try to save it, all of those bits and pieces.
You have referred to yourself as a, and I love this phrase, a geographical determinist.
That was a long time ago.
Have you changed?
Probably, yeah. I don't know how determinist I am about anything anymore. I'm much more feeling in a world of flux and change and everything slipping and sliding around rather than having fixed determinist positions.
I know this is talked about a lot in your work, a happy ending versus a grim story that we are left with. But in this case, we know where this is going. This book ends in 2013. We know where this is headed. You, just in your answer, seem to deliberately be saying that it's slipping and sliding, that it's squishy and maybe we still have a shot.
Maybe we still have a shot. I really like to believe that. There are many people who do not believe that, but I would like to. Hope springs eternal and all that sort of thing. As one of the characters says at the end, how can it fail when so many people are fighting to save it? The answer isn't known. We don't know which way for sure it's going to go. So you pays your money and you takes your choice, I guess.
As a woman who has spent so much time in a landscape with the land, appreciating it and living with it, ultimately noticing it and sharing it with us. I ask the question of why do you think that so many of us don't do that and ultimately take it for granted?
Well, we're full of denial. We tend to think of things as persisting rather than falling away. That's why some of this Anthropocene art is so interesting. It often features people or buildings or other human constructs on this projecting piece of rock while underneath everything is gone. And the person standing on the what looks to be solid ground from the top seem utterly unconcerned. They haven't a clue that there's nothing below. This new art really is interesting to me. And in a way, Barkskins is like that. It's like the piece of land that we're still standing on, but maybe beneath us it's gone, eroded, washed away.
There is an epigraph to this book.
I was trained as an historian, and history remains my great love. Lynn White Jr. is an historian I have always liked intensely. And this essay that I think he wrote in the early 1960s has stayed with me forever. It's very powerful. When you begin to ask yourself the question of how did we come to think and believe as we do about the natural world, what is there in us that makes us think that it's for us? And Lynn White Jr. wrote this very trenchant and powerful essay, and that's what this epigraph comes from. Shall I read that?
Please do.
It's likely to make some people very angry. But that's good, too. Okay, Professor White said, "In antiquity, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own genius loci, its guardian spirit. These spirits were accessible to men, but were very unlike men. Centaurs, fauns, and mermaids show their ambivalence. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation and to keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects."
As you said, that could make people angry, and you also said that that's okay.
Well, I hope it makes people think and just ask the question that I was asking. How did we come to be the way we are in regards to nature? Is every human like that? There are groups of people who are not like that, who still hold to an animistic attitude, who still see in the natural world something of great value and themselves as related to that world.
So what's hard for my brain to compute is how spiritual nature itself can be, and how the two could cohabitate quite nicely if we allowed that.
If we allowed, yes. Is it a question of attitude? Is it something inborn in us? It's a point of departure that I hope will provoke some people to think about it.
I finished this novel 4 or 5 days ago. It's stayed with me. It's been with me. It has given me a lot to think about. I assume that is something you like to hear.
Yes, that's all I'm asking, is that readers think about it and consider the ecological holism that is possible and where they fit in, what people can do actively, and just consider it. That's all. I'm calling your attention to something that's going on kind of book.
You have said you don't give a lot of thought to the characters. The characters are very simple for you to write. So once you have the construct, then you can move them around, and that is easier for you.
Ooh, it's not so much that they get moved around. They are invented to fit a particular time. The period in which they appear is what I've done the work on. And once you know what goes on in those periods, then a character more or less springs into being automatically. I'm not trying to say that they're cliches, but maybe they are to some
people.
Not
at all. I remember years ago when the shipping news first came out, I saw you at a book reading in Vermont, and you were talking about the writing. And I think someone in the audience asked you why you write, and you said that it was something that you found easy to do.
Well, easier than most any other job for me, anyway.
Which you said what began as a historian. So was this a way, because this is a monumental project, was that a challenge for you?
Certainly, it was. It was a challenge. There comes a point in your life when you want to do something larger than small. You just want to do a big thing, whatever it is. So I guess this book was the big thing for me. I'm not going to sit down and do another one. But I think it has a lot to do with age and attitude and where you've been and where you're going and how much time you've got and that kind of thing.
It's fascinating in reading your story of how much you have traveled around this country, but also the world, and that was your beginning. You certainly you moved from place to place as a child.
True.
And now you're in Seattle, but that seems maybe that's temporary.
Maybe. I'm not actually in the city. I'm not a city person. I'm outside the city, and it's comfortable that way. But who knows? I do have a thing about shifting ground. It's expensive and rather stupid, but I keep doing it.
And does that come out of curiosity? Does that come out of wanting to know more history and more about place?
Partly that, and partly because I seem to have itchy feet. I don't know why. It's my great despair. I don't know what's wrong with me that I have to keep going to a different place. I think my children regard me with some amusement. As the mother who won't stay in one fixed place. So, yeah, it's a major fault.
It's interesting that you think of it as a fault.
Oh, I do.
Really? Because many would look at it with some envy to say that you have had the opportunity to move around and to be able to experience, especially even from East Coast of New England, growing up in New England, to Wyoming, and then to the western part of the United States.
They would not say that if they had to pack many, 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 many boxes of books. That's my problem.
I read a wrenching story about the books you had to leave behind.
Oh, my dear, it was too sad. I really, really did not like that. People who talk glibly about downsizing, I would like to have at least one of them here to give a good smack. Downsizing is painful and difficult and awful, but moving is even more awful, so one has to do it. And I did have to get rid of several thousand books when I shifted ground from Wyoming to Washington. I miss the books. I miss them all. And some I've even had to replace. I miss them so badly.
And I guess people who don't have that relationship with books and with literature wouldn't understand.
No, but of course not.
I couldn't deal without my books. I wouldn't be able to.
Well, I don't have any pets. I have books instead. And I don't think the relationship is that different from what I can see of the people I know who own pets.
When you have a book, because from my understanding, it's all over the place. It's history, it's nonfiction, it's fiction, literature.
Mm-hmm.
Contemporary?
Yes, surely. Mm-hmm.
And things that you dip into and then dip out of when you revisit them.
Right. And I do revisit, so yes.
Do you do that with your own work?
Never. When something is published, I can keep it on a shelf, but that's it. I don't, unless I'm asked a specific question, then I'll go look again. But I do not spend any time going back to things that I've written before. I just don't do it. I'm not interested. I know what happened. I remember enough so that, okay.
Isolation is such a part of your work and your body of work. It also is very much the life of a writer, of being isolated.
Mm-hmm.
You do not like this part of the equation of talking about the work and going out and pushing a book.
Yeah, it's hard because one writes the book and likes to think, there you go, baby, you're on your own. but it isn't quite that way. Many of the things that I've written have been misconstrued or have needed explanation or whatever. And this one does seem to need more explanation than most, simply because the characters overshadow the story. The characters are lively and vivid in many places, so readers tend to concentrate on them. They appear, they do things, they disappear, but that's not what the story is about.
And not to overgeneralize, but they have wonderful names and they die in fantastic ways.
Yes.
Which must be a lot of fun.
Well, I don't write them that way for fun, but to illustrate that the past was a place where accidents were much more common, unusual accidents, than they are today. We have safe lives in many, many ways, much safer than working with axes or making knives or machinery that's not really well understood or traipsing through the wild woods. So all of the deaths are in there to illustrate the period.
And obviously, since it goes over 300 years, people are going to die.
Yes, they have to, because no one lives quite that long.
And make way for the next characters,
yes,
to come in. You will keep writing, but not necessarily for us.
Who will I be writing for?
Well, I hope you're writing for us. I've heard you say, though, that you will keep writing, but you don't want this process again.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes. Not for publication, right.
Right.
I'm old enough now, so I can sit around and write if I want to, but that's all I have to do is scribble and let things happen at their own speed, but not go traipsing around babbling about it.
Let me ask a question that I think you're going to hate.
Oh.
But I want to ask it anyway, which is, do you think that writing a book like this and adding to this, the literature of this time that you had mentioned earlier, can make a difference?
I'm not sure that it can make a difference, and that was not the motivation to write it. Same thing with Brokeback Mountain. The motivation was the story, but it was not the characters. It was a story about homophobia in rural places. And whether it made a difference or not, I don't know. But a lot of things did happen in the years following its publication. As for this, I don't know whether it's going to make a difference or not. My hope is that it will make people think about climate change, think about deforestation, think about the natural world a bit more than they have. And that's all I hope.
With Brokeback Mountain, so many people obviously know it more from the film than from the short story. The short story is one of many in a collection. Were you surprised of how it was taken out of context?
Only for a little while. I think once you do realize that you are a writer, whether you want to be or not, that things are going to be taken out of context. Almost everything that happens to us, almost everything we say, almost everything we do is taken out of context by someone or other. So I feel, what is the context anyway, and how much does it matter? If someone takes it another way, so what? So that's sort of my attitude.
There is a character, Bernard, in the book who is transgender, and you do not dwell on it. It is only
right,
a page or two. But it is, I assume it's something that you thought about that you wanted to add to the equation.
I wanted to have such a situation in there somewhere. I mean, all of these things that are happening now with transgender and who's what sex and so forth, all of these questions that are daily boiling up are not new. It's just that this is the first time we've begun openly discussing them. But such things did happen in the past. And there, I've read a couple of instances where there were real episodes where a man and a wife who'd been living together forever, and the husband died first, and then the wife finally died and was discovered that it was no wife at all, it was another man. There are plenty of, not plenty, but there are a few instances of that sort. So I like to get that in there. We're not unique.
The name of the new novel is Barkskins. It is published by Scribner. Annie Prue, what a great pleasure to speak with you.
Joe, very wonderful to be with you again.
Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Special thanks to Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.